So, all right, so some reflections then, building on our conversation about emptiness. Wrote a little bit today. Felt a little bit rushed writing, so I don't know if I got all my thoughts down, but they're rooted in, we started last week looking a bit at just the beginning of the Diamond Sutra. This is a text that is from the very earliest of the Mahayana writings. This is a handful of hundreds of years after the Buddha. It's the beginning of what's known as the Perfection of Wisdom literature, or the Prajnaparamita, which is both a body of texts and kind of a new turning of the wheel of the Dharma from the early system, and is also the name of a goddess or a bodhisattva, perfect wisdom. She is known as the mother of the Buddhas because, of course, Buddhas become Buddhas because of wisdom. And so the goddess of perfect wisdom must be the mother of the Buddhas. So Prajnaparamita, mother of all the Buddhas. And the sutra, the Diamond Sutra, Vajracchedika, the diamond cutter, or the diamond that cuts through illusions. It begins with the Buddha going on alms round, coming back after the meal, settling down. And one of his students, a bodhisattva in the group named Subhuti, asking a question. Subhuti asks, what's kind of the standard question about practice in these texts, which is, Blessed One, if a son or daughter of noble family, and here we can broaden that to encompass the entire gender spectrum, if a young person of a noble family, and we can encompass that to the entire class spectrum as well, noble meaning noble in actions and intention and noble of heart, if a person coming from supportive conditions is ready to embark upon the bodhisattva path, how should they stand, how should they walk, and how should they control their thoughts? And the Buddha says, good, good, Subhuti, that's a good question you asked. One who wants to embark upon the bodhisattva path needs to enter training. So this is the right question. How should they stand? How should they walk? How should they control their thoughts? And then the Buddha gives the answer that we looked at last time, which was the one who wishes to enter the path of the bodhisattva should give birth to this thought that whatever beings there are, no matter how they're born, from a womb, from the air, from moisture, spontaneously, all of those beings in all the three times, so throughout all of eternity, I vow to liberate them all. But though I liberate them all, not a single being is liberated. Why is that? Because the bodhisattva that gives rise to the perception that there are beings to be liberated is not a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is one who does not give rise to the perception of a being, a life, or a soul. So you get a practical question. How does the person on the path of the bodhisattva stand, walk, and work with their mind? And then you get a really wild, emptiness-oriented mystical answer. They vow to save all beings, and they do so by realizing that there's no such thing as beings. Chew on that for a few mahakalpas. It's a very long time, which is how long the bodhisattva path takes. So you have a while, no rush. But what do we make of this? And we talked a bit last week, about the emptiness side of this. Like, really, this is just building on the insight that's core to the Buddha's teachings, that everything, which includes beings like ourselves, but also includes objects and experiences and all that, empty of a solid, permanent, unchanging essence that you could call a self or a soul. So empty doesn't mean there's nothing there. Emptiness doesn't mean it's not real. Emptiness means there's not an eternal essence present. If there was an eternal essence, it would by definition not be able to change. If it couldn't change, you couldn't get liberated. And so systems that hold that we have an eternal unchanging essence, they have to do a maneuver of making that essence essentially not different from God, from the whole universe. And so variations of this maneuver are at the heart of Vedanta, are at the heart of the Samkhya system, where there's the Purusha and the Prakriti, the Purusha being the unchanging, eternal bit. In the yoga and Samkhya system, the Purusha is a little bit more individual. In the Vedanta system, the Atman, the soul, is a little bit more not separate from the divine, from Brahman. But for the Buddha, he didn't take that maneuver. He said, no, that's a concept. It's also empty. All states are empty. All states of being are empty. And so the Bodhisattva is one who resides in emptiness, who relies on emptiness, who rests in emptiness. And this gives them the ability to see through the idea that there are distinct beings to be saved, therefore they save all beings. So that's a mystery that we'll keep unpacking a little bit here. But I want to rewind from that for to talk about the first part of the question. The son or daughter of noble family who wishes to embark upon the Bodhisattva path, how do they stand? How do they walk? How do they work with their minds? So, how do they stand? How do they walk? Is traditionally interpreted in the commentaries of various kinds as a question about training. It's a question about practice, right? What do you do with your body and how do you move around through the world? So, how do you attend to, how do you stand? So, that the first part is stillness. How do you attend to stability? So, first of all, how do you get your balance? You know, if metaphorically you're kind of always falling over in various ways, getting pulled off your center by circumstances. How do you find a stable posture first? And then, having found that stable posture, how do you move from there? So, how do you walk in a way that has intention, that has directionality, that has intent to it? And questions of how practitioners move through the world come down to ethics. Which in Pali is sila, virtue, ethics, morals, morality. The Sanskrit parallel is shila, that you'll find in the Mahayana texts. I'll use the Pali. Sila for lay people, non-monastics, is generally glossed as the five precepts. In the early texts, in the Pali canon, the five precepts are not always five. Very often, the fifth one is missing. That's the intoxicants one. And instead, the fourth on speech is broken out into four parts. So there's very often a list of seven things that's actually given. But five is the general list that's come down to us. And they, in their simplest form, are renunciations. They're actions that are relational, that harm others, that we should then be extremely cautious around, and to the extent that we can, abstain from causing harm. So those five precepts, as many of you know, are the prohibition against taking life, against taking that which is not offered to one, or stealing, against committing sexual misconduct, against false speech. So lying is the primary, and when it's broken out into four, it contains lying, harsh speech, divisive speech, and nonsense speech or idle chatter. And then the fifth is taking intoxicants that cloud the mind. And so let me reflect a little bit about each of these in their kind of very literal or fairly straightforward Theravadin approach, and then we'll bust out from there a little bit. The main thing that I want to bring forward with the precepts is first of all that they're vague. So they have the nature of being explorations or inquiries, somewhat more than they have the nature of being like commandments or strict prohibitions. Some of them are fairly literal, like not taking life, so not killing sentient beings. That's fairly literal, but a lot of people nowadays, with good reason, I do this some myself, can feel into that prohibition to not take life, and feel into it a more generalized intention to not cause harm, even secondarily. So, for instance, folks will often have as a laboratory for the first precept, the complex questions about what we should eat. Should we eat meat? Should we kill beings to eat them? What beings should we kill to eat them? And I don't really have a horse in that race, so I'm not going to talk about that too much, because I think it's partly a dead end, partly because it's so emotionally charged that every time we get into it, it derails the whole conversation. But mostly because questions about harm that happens secondarily to our actions very quickly become a slippery slope that encompasses everything in the world. So, if I, it's one thing to choose not to kill animals for my food. So, that's one thing. It would be a next step to say, I'm not going to buy animals that were killed. That seems reasonable to a lot of people. Like my buying them causes them to be killed. It might go further to say, I'm not going to participate in industries that kill animals. Like even though eating eggs or drinking milk doesn't directly kill the animal, those industries kill animals, like excessive males, for instance. But that slope of what are the effects of my actions broadly, it just goes further and further, right? There's aspects of industrial agriculture that kill all sorts of animals that, that I always have to make choices about. What kind of farms do I get my vegetables? Where do I get my protein sources? Am I abstaining from, am I abstaining from eggs, but then eating a ton of, tropical nuts or almonds from the Central Valley that take too much water? And there's a million examples all the way along this spectrum, right? All the way, there's no pure, that is to say, absolutely non-harming way to eat. It's really important to land here because this is the basis of why all the precepts are sites of inquiry and practice rather than concrete prohibitions. It's never been part of the Buddhist system to say you should not cause any harm at all. First of all, because that's impossible. Like being alive, we're interdependent, and actually the theory of interdependence is more important in a certain way than where you draw the line on harming. Everything is relational. So everything affects other beings. Every way of eating or dressing or moving through the world affects other beings. The fact that this is true does not make meaningless figuring out where you feel best along the spectrum of harm being caused. I know, a friend of a friend is a relatively famous radical environmentalist who, spent their life writing about the terrible harms of, the fossil fuel industry and writing about climate change. But my friend who knew them said that they didn't seem to have any ethical standards whatsoever about what they ate. They would just stop at the fast food place and eat terrible meat and all of these things. And my friend was like, how can you do that? And the famous environmentalist was like, you don't get it. On a planetary level, this doesn't matter at all. So they were sort of sticking their pin in, what's going to affect the global system. And if it wasn't really going to be, if it was really a drop in the bucket in the global system, they didn't care. And so The encouragement, I think, that is most helpful for us to take on in relation to a precept like not taking life is that at the heart of all the precepts is this very practical recognition for in the sense of meditation and inner cultivation, which is that when we are living in a way where our conscience is relatively clear, the heart can settle. And so, let's say in relation to resource usage, I'll broaden it from food, but the things I wear, the fuel I drive with, the things I eat, what I buy, all of that stuff. Every part of this system now is global, and that means every part of it, has the potential to cause harm, and some of it we know causes terrible harm. What do you give up? And what is right for you not to give up in this moment, knowing that there's no, there's no pure place to hide out. That would be great if there was, but it's actually better for our liberation that there's not, because we're embedded in the whole thing, and it's much more difficult to learn how to work with complexity and ambiguity than it is to be somehow protected from having to confront complexity and ambiguity. Right? So there's dukkha at every level of the system. But not all dukkha is the same. Like, it matters. The difference between, the difference between eating the kale that I grew in the garden and some microbes died versus, going out and, I don't know, I think they shot 1,500 bison in Yellowstone this week, for a reason that I can't quite fathom, but I feel sad for the bison. It's just different, or there's so many examples. The choices we make matter. Not all dukkha is the same, but there's dukkha at every level. So, right? So you get how the task here is not to somehow decide what's the most pure thing and then feel self-satisfied that we've attained it and then be critical of everyone else for not doing that. Is actually to find, how can I live in an interdependent world in a way where my heart is at ease? Where can I actually find what's called the bliss of blamelessness? This means like my intentions are clear, my actions are as wholesome as I can make them right now, and I'm somehow avoiding as best I can, right, the slings and arrows, right, of guilt and shame, but also blame and hatred of others. And the sign that we're doing this with some success is that when we bring our attention into the field of our own actions, there's a kind of ease, right? There's a decrease of stress rather than an increase of stress and anxiety. And so I think this is a helpful principle then for all of the precepts, right? For stealing or not taking that which isn't offered. Again, there's ways that we can interpret this very literally, and there's ways that, living within global capitalism, there's all sorts of things that we're not offered, that we partake in, that we participate in various ways. We start our we often almost always include in our go around, acknowledgments of the land we live on that in for most of us, was stolen from other folks under in dire violent ways. This is the it's the nature of being it's the nature of being well in the world as it is now to be the recipient of some privilege that that always has shadows. Again, just the same as with eating, the idea is not to somehow find the pristine life where you're sheltered from that, right? Good luck. You can't, there's nowhere to go. There's no other planet to go to that isn't marked by colonialism in every square meter of the earth. So what do you do, right? How do you live in a way with the intent and the attempt to not take that which isn't offered, but then also to live undiluted about how the world has come to be what it is and how we participate, how we can affect change, all of those things. The third precept is the precept for lay people is to avoid sexual misconduct. And again, this one has, some layers that that hopefully seem obvious and easy to keep. The earliest interpretations, the literal interpretations we have in the precepts are purely patriarchal, right? They are don't do things with other men's wives, to leave it in the heteronormative patriarchy space. Nowadays, it gets generalized to, broad frameworks of operating within consent. The world of what constitutes wholesome intimate relating in the postmodern world, it's gotten bigger than just consent. And there's conversations out there around how consent is in a certain way not enough, or it's not the only thing that should be present. There's more realms to sensuality and intimacy than consent. And some young people that I know, teenagers, we were the more adult adults were talking at a certain point, being like, oh, these teenagers, they've got their first sweetheart, but like they're being so cautious. They're not dating, they're hardly touching, they're not kissing, they're checking in with each other constantly. They're having conversations like, I really like you, but if we do anything, that might cause a rupture in our friend circle. And if it went badly, that could really be bad, in so on, out on social, people could really get trashed. So we should be extremely cautious about what we do, right? So, there's lots of conversations out there about what right conduct in the realm of sensuality and sexuality is now. And it's not a precept where you can just be like, aha, I have the black and white solution to this, and I am now no longer, I no longer have to think about it. I think partly it comes down to that with all of them. It's like, I kind of wish there was a place where I could land to just be like, I do this, and now I don't ever think about it. I'm vegetarian, therefore I never have to think about this. I'm faithful to my wife, and therefore I never have to think about this. But actually, I don't steal things, except that I slightly overdeduct on my taxes. Does that count? I want what I find myself wanting is to not have to engage in the problem. That's the thing, right? And you just can't, right? You have to engage. That's the whole thing about ethics being relational and contextual. So there's the third precept. The fourth is wise speech. And of course, there's all the layers of how communication works, right? Not to lie, but also all the layers of that, and how the wise speech precept so often gets spun out to be like, don't lie, but also avoid harsh speech, avoid divisive speech, and avoid what is sometimes translated as idle chatter, useless speech. And so, maybe sometimes it's easy to be like, oh yeah, I've abstained from gossip, and then someone's like, I don't think this is gossip, but you should really know about what's happening with these people. And you're like, oh, this is important to know. Oh, wait, we're gossiping. And it's like, it's not clear always which is which. It's also not clear in the realm of political speech, activist speech. There's times when something that sounds like harsh speech is, seems fairly appropriate to the circumstances. There's times when, I wonder if there's times when divisive speech would be appropriate to the circumstances, So there, that is for inquiry. And then the last one, the one that often gets omitted from the early texts, but definitely shows up after a while very regularly, is the precept around intoxicants. Of course, this one has so much complexity right now as we live in a more and more and more complexly and highly medicated society. And just all of the questions that, again, there's no safe black and white place to land, you know. The word for intoxicants originally just meant alcohol, so you can take that party line and be like, well, it says that, but doesn't include anything else, but that can get you into tr some trouble. Does intoxicants mean, you know, prescription medications? You could get into pretty terrible, heedless trouble with those. Does it include all, you know, does it preclude all non-legal medications? Who says the law is any arbiter of health? So there's some non-legal medicines that are wonderful for you, and there's some non-legal medicines that are truly terrible for you. And the heart of the precept on intoxicants is actually about your actions again. It's not about what happens internal to you. All the precepts are relational. So it's really about what it does to your sense of mindfulness and conscience. So there's some scholarship out there that says that the precept on intoxicants, properly translated, is actually a precept against drunkenness. That it's not actually the substance that's the heart of the issue. It's actually the actions that arise when the substance is misused. And so, you know, intoxicants that lead to heedlessness, it's like, well, it's the heedlessness that's at issue, not actually the change of state. If changing your state in a way that could potentially lead to, you know, unskillful action was the problem, you know, there's days when I should really be a little more mindful of coffee and sugar, which can certainly lead to heedlessness. As anyone who has, you know, sent a delicate email too fast while under too much caffeine, or seen any child under too much sugar knows. So all of this then is a way to say that the precepts don't come with an easy menu of how you should follow them, because our lives are different. And lots of fundamentalists will come in and tell you that they actually do, and that the menu that they've happened to follow is the right one. But there's always going to be exceptions in gray areas. And so I want to encourage us then to have an active practice, not so much of deciding what our, you know, where we stand on the spectrum of any of the precepts, but actually an active practice of a kind of ethical inquiry, basically all the time. So in any situation, there's going to be questions like, what's the most skillful thing to say? You know, what should I do in this moment? These core ethical inquiries then are supported by the precepts, right? So something's going on and a little alarm bell goes off, and you're like, have we strayed into wrong speech, you know, into unskillful speech, harmful speech, you know? Or you're just chatting with someone and you're like, oh, have we crossed over a line into the realm of, you know, potential, you know, sexual misconduct? Like we're not doing anything yet, but like, oh, we're in that zone. That could happen. And the precepts are there to remind you that you're in that zone with any of them, you know. And then mindfulness kicks in, discernment kicks in, and there's a process of figuring out, oh, and here I'll wrap it to finish, just back to that original question from the Diamond Sutra. The noble child of a good family who wishes to walk the Bodhisattva path, how should they stand? How should they walk? How should they work with the heart, mind? How should they control their thoughts? And so, at any moment in our lives, what the precepts are is they're a kind of tripwire or a sort of force field. It's not as crisp as a wire, it's more like a big blurry field. But you notice, like, oh, I'm in the zone. I'm in the zone of taking what isn't offered. And the way that I practice with that is anytime I think of a precept, I try to slow down and see what it's pointing to. Even if I immediately think that I'm overreacting and everything is fine, I trust that if the precept arose in my consciousness, It did so for a reason. And maybe that reason is like, I'm oversensitive because of some trauma from long ago. That's great. Work on that, or at least notice that. But if it's arising, respect it and see what it's pointing to. And then you get to make a decision. You say, no, all right, thank you. I think we're okay. I think we're okay. You know, and you go on. And 10 minutes later, if it arises again, respect it. And be like, oh, really? Are we still okay? You know? And they're there to protect you. So I'll pause there. So we have just a couple minutes for responses. And then next week, what we'll do is, at least this is my intention in the moment, is we'll take this and we'll weave it back into the emptiness teachings, and we'll talk about like, this is all very like, this means this, and this harms this, and self and other and relational. How does that unfold through the lens of emptiness and the, the there are no other beings kind of realization? How do we bring these two bodies of teaching into kind of active relationship? So that's fun. So we'll get there.